Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Here's the jaundiced view of America right now. It's the disunited states. Divisions everywhere. Vast political divides hardening into warring tribalism. Economic and racial divides. Americans facing off in the streets, at the polls, and how they go about living their everyday lives. But the pandemic, protests, and politics also offer an opportunity to flip the script about this society, about all human society, in fact. There's a chance here to rethink some fundamental assumptions about human nature, to reset our presumptions about how we're wired. That, in fact, perhaps the default state of the human condition might just be decency, altruism, and kindness. And if we really believed that, how would societies reorganize themselves around those principles? Or is that even possible, given the other truth about human history and its long and bloody trail of violence, atrocity, and war? So this hour on Point, a historian makes the case for a future where decency prevails. And that historian is Rutger Bregman. He is an historian and writer at The Correspondent in the Netherlands. His latest book is Humankind, A Hopeful History. And he makes the case that most folks deep down are decent and hardwired to cooperate. Rutger Bregman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst, and he's with us as always from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Rutger.
Well, I wanted to start, Rutger, with one of the most fascinating stories in your book, Humankind, and that is about a real-life Lord of the Flies scenario, because I can still remember the day and the place I was when I read William Golding's classic novel. I was in seventh grade, and I was in the library of my middle school, and I found the book. It was kind of off in, I guess, the G section of the fiction shelves, and I pulled it out and I started reading it, and I sat there in the library and ended up reading the whole thing cover to cover because I was transfixed. And I do have to say, it might have for a time changed my view about my fellow seventh graders at the moment. But you're saying the story of Ralph and Peggy and Jack and their descent into sort of a primal violence is not at all what happened to a group of boys who in real life were stranded on an island?
Exactly. You know, Meghna, I had a quite similar experience when I was around 16 or 17 years old, when I read Lord of the Flies and felt quite cynical afterwards. But it was only, you know, during the research for this book, which is really about this new view of human nature that is emerging among scientists. You know, so many scientists from so many different disciplines are moving to a more hopeful view of who we are as a species. And so during that research, I wondered whether it had ever really happened. You know, Lord of the Flies is fiction. It's great fiction. I mean, William Golding, the author, won the Nobel Prize for it. But then, you know, has it ever really happened? So I started on this journey and I spent, six, 7 months of my life on it. And after a while, I actually discovered that it did happen. Once in 1965, there were six kids in Tonga, which is an island group in the Pacific Ocean near Australia. And these kids were also part of a boarding school. They were fed up with school. They thought it was boring. They hated the school meals. And they said, you know what? Let's go on an adventure. And that's what they did. They borrowed or stole, I should say, a boat. And they ended up in a storm already on the first day. Drifted for 8 days and then shipwrecked on this island called Ata. It's like a very remote, it's basically a rock that sticks out of the sea. And amazingly, they managed to survive there for 50 months. So yeah, when I discovered that story, I thought, like, I want to know what happened, you know? And I was really wondering whether I could still track them down, these people, because back then they were 13, 14 years old. So now they must be like 17 years old. So that's what I tried to do, to actually find the real life Lord of the Flies kids.
Well, so, and the fascinating thing about this story is that you said they managed to survive for 15 months on their own on this island in the middle of nothing but water. And not only survive, but the way in which they survived is pretty much the exact opposite of the story that Golding told, 10 or 11 years before that, right? They formed a cooperative society, these young teenage boys. Can you tell us more about exactly what they did?
Well, in almost every single way, it's the opposite of the fictional Lord of the Flies. So in the real Lord of the Flies, these kids cooperated by working in teams. So two to be on the lookout for ships, two to work in the garden, and two to cook. Sometimes they did end up in fights. You know, that happens, especially as a teenager. But then what they would do is that one would go to one side of the island, the other would go to the other side of the island. They would cool off for a couple of hours, come back and say sorry. They also had this sort of curious gym that they built with their own weights. They had their own badminton court. So when the Australian captain named Peter Warner found them, after 15 months and sort of rescue them. Well, rescue is not really the right word because, I mean, they could have lived there for decades if they would have wanted to. But yeah, they were fine. They were in a good condition. Their health was really good. One of the boys had broke a leg with an accident, but, you know, they had managed to cure that with traditional medicine. So yeah, if this would have been a fictional Hollywood movie, people would say, oh, this is so sentimental. This is so unrealistic. That would never happen. But here we are. This is the real Lord of the Flies.
Well, and about the way they resolve disputes, that to me is very key, right? Because what you're describing is somehow they arrived rather quickly at this intentional plan that if there was going to be a dispute, the first thing that would happen would be a cooling off period. Now, when you managed to find, as you said, to find the then grown men when you investigated this story. Did they tell you like sort of how they came up with that system of dispute resolution rather than things just descending into fighting?
I think it happened organically and naturally. Okay. I mean, two of the boys were a little bit older, so they were the leaders. Religion was important for them as well. So the day started with prayer and it ended with prayer. Music was very important. One of the guys was a musician and he managed to build a guitar out of some of the remains of the boats that had been wrecked on the island. But there wasn't really like a top-down plan or anything. It just happened. And you know, the crazy thing is that they're even friends up until this day. So when this Australian captain found them, they decided to start working together, and they worked for decades, you know, on his fishing boat, and they still go out sailing regularly every now and then. So it's as I said, it's the opposite of the fictional Lord of the Flies.
Well, and I think the important thing in this example is exactly what you said, that it just happened. It was organic.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's fundamental to the argument you're trying to make in the book, that the default state of humanity, at least in this case, when thrown into a scenario where survival was absolutely paramount, the boys chose to work together.
Yeah, exactly. And I understand that some people may think, well, this is just an anecdote, right? It's a nice anecdote, but it's not. It's not like real science. And that's true. You know, I would say, though, that if millions of kids have to read the fictional Lord of the Flies, then let's also tell them about the one time that we actually know of that real kids shipwrecked on an island, because that's a very hopeful story. But I also think it's important because I think it's not the exception. It's actually the rule. So biologists, they now talk about this whole notion of survival of the friendliest. So not survival of the nastiest, not survival of the smartest, but survival of the friendliest, which means that for millennia, it was actually the friendliest among us who had the biggest chance of passing on their genes to the next generation, because friends help you to survive in a tough environment, you know, and we've been living for a very long time during the Ice Age, which was a very tough environment. So back then, you know, you didn't survive if you had a lot of possessions or if you were very arrogant or a narcissist or anything like that. No, you needed friends. And this has really been central to our evolution as a species. It's really what distinguishes us from other hominid species. It's the reason why we're still here and the Neanderthals are gone, because we are just so good at cooperating. We're able to cooperate on a scale that no other species in the whole animal kingdom can.
Well, Jack, you've been listening patiently here. Are you convinced about, let me call it, Homo amicus?
Well, I haven't felt so good about the human prospect since I saw that documentary about Mr. Rogers. Rutger talks about mean world syndrome. People get it from watching too much television. I'm a victim of it. I was beginning to think it was a mean world from watching all that television. I was beginning to think that it's actually true that there are over 300 million guns in America. Foolish idea. Of course there aren't. I was beginning to think that I didn't hear this ghoul on Fox News the other day say that the protesters, be ready when they come for you, he was saying, presumably to some of those well-armed Americans. I was beginning to think that we really weren't cooperating to defeat this scourge of a virus, and that as David Brooks put it, we weren't even capable of putting on a frigging mask to help one another. So I had all these crazy ideas drawn from the news that just convinced me it was a mean world, and I'm glad to know that underneath all that, we're better than we seem, or that we're depicted.
But are you so you're convinced, Jack? I mean, many of those stories are actually they're true. They're real. People are fighting about those things.
I guess I'm having a hard time reconciling what I want to believe and what the mean world syndrome is telling me is so.
Okay, so we're going to talk about why, when we come back from a break, why, as Jack puts it, so many of us are immersed in this mean world syndrome. I'm talking this hour with Rutger Bregman. He is author of a new book called Humankind, A Hopeful History, making the case that the fundamental state of the human condition is one of decency. We'll hear a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Rutger Bregman. He's a historian and a writer in the Netherlands, and he's written a new book. It's received a lot of acclaim. It's called Humankind, A Hopeful History. And in it, Rutger makes the case that the default condition, or the fundamental condition within all people, is one of decency, altruism, and cooperation. And what would societies look like if we actually organized around those principles instead of around cooperation? Instead of around not cooperating, around individualism and fear. I'm also joined today by Jack Beattie. He is On Point's news analyst, and he's with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Now, Rutger, one of the basic ways that you frame this exploration of what human beings really are is through sort of the endless tensions between Thomas Hobbes on the one end and Jean-Jacques Rousseau on the other. So tell us a little bit about why you chose the Hobbesian versus Rousseau view of human nature as the way to explore who we really and what we really are.
Yes, so these are two of the most famous philosophers, especially in political philosophy. They've been so influential. On the one hand, you have Thomas Hobbes, a British philosopher who, back in the 17th century, made the argument in his big book that's called The Leviathan, where he said that in the state of nature, you know, when we were still nomadic hunter-gatherers, which we've been for 95% of our history, We were living lives that were, in his famous words, nasty, brutish, and short. And we were even engaged in a so-called war of all against all. But luckily, at one point, we decided to sign a so-called social contract. We decided to appoint a very powerful ruler, a Leviathan in his word. So then we started the history of civilization, and everything's been better since then. We sort of gave up our liberty, but we got security in return. Now, that's Hobbes. Rousseau made the absolute opposite argument. So Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, is a French philosopher who said that, no, in the state of nature, life was actually pretty good. You know, we were healthy, we were free, we could do what we want. You know, that was the better life. But then when we settled down, when we invented private property in particular, everything went downhill. You know, there was a terrible decision. And since then, we've, you know, been living these horrible lives and in very hierarchical societies with a lot of oppression, et cetera, et cetera. Now, usually Thomas Hobbes is described as the realist, as, you know, the father of realism. And Rousseau is described as the revolutionary, sentimental, romantic. And I used to believe that as well. But when I started to look at the latest evidence we have from particularly anthropology and archaeology, I started to realize that actually this so-called naive guy, Rousseau, well, it seems that he was actually right about most of the things, that indeed the vast majority of our history, when we still lived as nomadic hunter-gatherers, life was, you know, better at least than when we were farmers and city dwellers. We lived lives that were healthier and more relaxed and much more peaceful as well.
How do you know that?
Well, that's a great question. It's obviously very, very hard to know how people lived like 30,000 years ago, but we've got important evidence here. So in the first place, you can obviously look at tribes or nomadic hunter-gatherers that still live today or in the 19th century or the 20th century, because we know we were nomadic hunter-gatherers for a long time. So you can look at them and see sort of how they organize themselves. And then what you see is again and again, you know, whether you're talking about people who live in, you know, the north in Alaska or in the desert of Namibia, the Kalahari Desert, you see strong similarities. So these are quite egalitarian societies where people have a relatively relaxed lifestyle, a working week of around 20, 30 hours, quite healthy as well. So infection diseases, for example, are quite modern phenomenon. Infection diseases like COVID-19, but also the plague and malaria and measles. These are all the results of us living too close together and living very close to our domesticated animals as well. So that's one important part of the puzzle. But you can also look at archaeology, of course. So if it was true, you know, that there really was a war of all against all, as Thomas Hobbes said, then you would expect that at some time, some artist from the Stone Age would have made a nice, you know, some kind of Guernica, you know, some kind of painting of this war that was going on back then. But we didn't find it. You know, there's literally nothing there. Actually, there are very few skeletons that have been found with any sound of signs of violence from our deep past. But then when we did settle down, when we did invent private property and started living in villages and cities, suddenly you see a lot of signs of violence. So that is suggestive. I'm not saying that we, you know everything for sure yet, but what we do know, and if you look at the consensus among archaeologists and anthropologists, I think it points in a much more hopeful direction about where we've come from than what people often believe.
With all due respect, just because, I don't know, the caves of Lascaux don't have scenes of human to human violence. I mean, perhaps who knows? Maybe the dwellers of Lascaux were about to do that, but someone thumped them over the head with a rock, and they couldn't get around to painting those images.
They made it later. So we know that after people settled down. So that's, I really think, the important moment in human history, when we were not nomads anymore, but we made the decision to, as Rousseau said it, invent private property. Then we actually do see a lot of cave paintings of people having a go at each other and archers ending up in fights, etc. So I obviously recognize that this is a really hard and big question, and you have to look at so many different pieces of the puzzle. But I think that a good case can be made that actually, deep down, we are more of a peaceful species than we think we are.
So, point taken, and I also want to talk with you in detail about sort of the emerging science that you mentioned, but I do just want to press this a little bit because it's entirely understandable how looking around now at the challenging start to the 21st century and definitely across what history wrought in the 20th century, that we might have a longing for the simplicity of an Arcadian past, if I can put it that way. But we're also romanticizing an existence, pre-agricultural existence, that was more than it was less even than subsistence, right? I mean, you're talking about a state of humanity at a time period that, while certain diseases may not have existed, they also didn't have the benefits, for example, that modern medicine has brought about in the past couple of centuries. So I want to just check us a little bit here on the understandable tendency to perhaps romanticize human life 30,000 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's a real danger, and you should be really wary of that. I mean, human beings are clearly not angels. We're capable of the most horrible things, even. I mean, we do things that are unseen in the animal kingdom. Think about ethnic cleansing and genocides and wars. I mean, there's a real dark side to our nature as well. Even though, luckily, I mean, in the past couple of decades, we have made a lot of progress. The question is just how sustainable that is. We don't know that yet, especially if you think about climate change and the extinction of species. But I'm not trying to paint a romantic picture here. What I'm trying to do is to show that indeed there's this silent revolution that's been going on in science, where so many scientists from different disciplines have moved to a different view of who we are, really, and that we are wired not to be sort of angels or anything or natural heroes or anything, but we are wired to cooperate. So, for example, what we do during a times of crisis, if you watch a Hollywood movie about what happens after a disaster or an earthquake or a pandemic or something like that, what you see is people who go nuts, you know, they all panic, they start looting, they start plundering. What we actually know now from more than 700 case studies done by sociologists is that what you get in reality is an explosion of cooperation. People from the left to the right, rich, poor, young, old, cooperating and working together. And that is, to me, something that's really important that people actually know that, because, you know, we humans, we are, or at least we become the stories that we tell ourselves. So cynicism can become sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we all really believe that deep down we are selfish, then we start designing our society around that idea and start building our schools and democracies and workplaces in such a way. And I think that can have really pernicious consequences. And I'm trying to turn that around.
Right. And so Jack, let me bring you back in here, because I think Rutger's saying that we become the stories that we tell ourselves is possibly one of the most powerful lessons from his book. And your thoughts on that?
Yeah, he calls it nocebo, sort of the opposite of placebo, a happy coinage indeed. Here's my trouble, Rutger. You talk about people coming together in crises. Last week, I think on Tuesday, Germany reported 800 new cases of coronavirus. The United States, 55,000. You know, here was a crisis. It called on Americans to think of each other, to show solidarity, to endure the inconvenience of a mask. And the result is that we are now the virus is running loose. You know, I don't have to go into the headlines. Something has failed here. Is it something in other words, this disproves, it seems to me, at a natural experiment level, your notion that decency is the default position. It doesn't seem that way in the U.S. of A today.
Well, the mask is a really interesting example, because when liberals or people on the left look at people on the right who refuse to wear a mask, what they see is selfishness. They see nasty behavior, like you don't care about other people. That's what they see. I believe that's not really what's happening. What's really happening is groupish behavior or sort of tribal behavior, where wearing a mask has become sort of a thing of one group. So people, progressives, people on the left, they wear a mask. You know, that's what they do because that's the good and the right thing to do. Then the other group doesn't do that anymore. So this is actually one of the big paradoxes, I think, that I talk about in my book, which is that on the one hand, we humans, we've evolved to be friendly and to work together. But on the other hand, that is often exactly the problem, because we can do the most horrible and nasty things in the name of friendship and in the name of loyalty and in the name of comradeship. So there are many examples of that. If you think about the Second World War, for example, and you ask the question, why did these German soldiers keep on fighting in 1944, 1945, when it was clear they were going to lose the war? Well, back then, what the Allied psychologists thought at first, that these soldiers must have been brainwashed. You know, they must have gone nuts or something like that. They must be ideological fanatics. But then they started interviewing prisoners of war and discovered that actually most soldiers were not all that fanatic, but they were simply fighting for their friends and they didn't want to let their comrades down. Now, I'm not saying this to sort of downplay any of the atrocities by Germany in the war. And I mean, there were many other factors involved as well. If you look at, you know, fanatic SS guards, it's a very different story where ideology was very important. But it is crucial to recognize that this friendliness, that our longing for connection, has this ironical and dark side as well. And I think that is exactly what you see at play here.
Well, so Rutger, if I may, a point taken about the question of why were German soldiers still fighting in 1944 and 45, mm-hmm. but what about 1939? I mean, because isn't that the other side of the coin here in terms of group identity? Because so let's just cut to the chase here. What you're talking about fundamentally is discussed in science as pro-social behavior, right? Mm-hmm. And I one of my favorite interviews that I had a chance to do was about a decade ago with the famed biologist E.O. Wilson, right? Because about in the 1970s was one of the champions of kinship relationship behavior theory, basically that you would fight to the end for your genetic kin. And then he himself evolved his thinking towards this idea that actually, no, we're human beings and a couple of other dozen species. He was particularly focused on insects, of course. We exhibit this pro-social behavior, that genetic kin isn't necessarily how we define our most important grouping, that we define them more in larger circles, if I can put it that way. But of course, in the same breath, he also said how we define those circles is exactly the source of all the darker parts of human history, as you're saying, right? So in 44, 45, those German soldiers may have defined their most important social circles, survival circles, as their fellow troop members. But something else happened in 1939, and the definition was far, far different, that propelled Germany and the German people into believing in a cataclysmic war that cost the lives of not only 6 million Jews, but, for example, 20 million Russians as well. So that like that's the forever tension, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. And I'm not denying any of that. I guess what I'm just saying is that, you know, there's this old theory in Western culture which says that civilization is only a thin veneer, and that under that veneer, under that thin layer, we are all just selfish and animals, you know. Deep down, we're just violent and aggressive and nasty. And I think that's really incorrect, that notion. We are capable of violence and of pretty horrible violence, but it's not quite natural to most of us. If you think about something like sex, I mean, we like that. Most of us do. And it's pretty easy to understand why we like it. I mean, there's a good evolutionary reason for it, because otherwise we would go extinct. The same is true for food and eating, right? You need it. But with violence, the interesting thing is that actually, if you sent soldiers to a war, you know, just average drafted soldiers, and they end up in a situation where they kill someone else, very often they're traumatized and they come back with PTSD. So they've killed someone, but they've also killed something inside themselves, which suggests to me that even though we're capable of this, it's not really what we've evolved to do. And indeed, this is also, I think, what you see in the biggest part of our history, is that war is a quite recent invention of the last 10,000 years. And that, you know, for the biggest part of our history, we live in much more flexible societies, where indeed, as we talked about earlier, we were nomads, and you made more friends from different groups. So I guess what I'm saying here is that this groupish thing that people, you know, stand in opposition to each other, it is not inevitable. And there are ways to overcome this that are, you know, not just artificial, but that we can actually build on our own nature when we try to do that.
Well, I want to talk about that a lot more when we come back. We are talking this hour with Rutger Bregman. His book is Humankind, A Hopeful History, where he argues for the fundamental decency of human beings. And as he just said, how would we organize our society if we believed in that presumption? How would we change our basic policies? Jack Beattie is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Rutger Bregman. He's a historian and writer for The Correspondent in the Netherlands and author of a fascinating book called Humankind, A Hopeful History. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And Jack Beattie is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst. And Jack, before we sort of move forward, press forward into exploring more of sort of Rutger's vision of what society might look like if we organized around principles of decency, are you convinced yet, Jack?
No, and perhaps the reason is I'm under the profundity mystique. That is, in Western literature and in philosophy, the darker the view, the assumption is that it's true. I mean, the tragic sense of life, the look into the abyss, Freud's picture in civilization and its discontents. We read these things and we think, by God, there we are. There I am. I'm in this world where I have to sacrifice some of my instinctual satisfaction in order to live in civilization, and that makes me forever unhappy. I have to accept that. Or we look at Hobbes with his metaphor of the social contract, and that sort of makes sense to us that these groups that Rutger talk about might well be at one another's throats were it not for some central authority. In short, the tradition in the West, the Western tradition, is dark and tragic and emphasizes not the smiling aspects of human nature at all. So to accept your view, I'm open to it, but I'm having to somersault over those years of looking into the abyss with D.H. Lawrence and Thomas Mann, et cetera.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Rutger, before I let you jump in here, can I just say something to Jack? Jack, we've known each other for quite a while now, and to hear you sort of reveal your looking to the abyss, into the abyss there, it saddens my heart a little, because you're also a great champion of the Enlightenment. I mean, it's the exact opposite, light, reason, thinking. Do the two dwell in tension in your heart, Jack?
Well,
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that is a situation that any serious student of modern literature confronts, that it does. It is anti-Enlightenment. It does emphasize the irrational and the dark and the twisted. And we have to somehow reconcile those things.
I don't think it's necessarily anti-Enlightenment, actually, to have a dark view of human nature. Many Enlightenment philosophers, such as David Hume and Thomas Hobbes and Adam Smith, did tend to emphasize, you know, the selfishness in humanity. And also the founding fathers of the United States. I mean, you could argue that the U.S. was founded on the dogma that people are just selfish. John Adams wrote an essay with the title, "All Men Would Be Tyrants If They Could." I think that, you know, throughout Western history, cynicism has been the ideology of those in power, because cynicism legitimizes their power, right? Because if people cannot trust each other, if they're really nasty and selfish, then they need those at the top. They need, you know, the kings and the bureaucrats and the monarchs and the queens and you name it, to rule them, to keep them in check. And then if other people would say, well, actually, I believe that people are pretty decent, and that we can actually work together, that's a really dangerous idea. That's subversive. Yeah. And I think it's also the reason why many of those who have advocated a more hopeful view in Western history have, you know, been persecuted. Rousseau was one example, but, you know, think of the Russian anarchists, someone like Kropotkin, Peter Kropotkin, who was one of the first to emphasize that there's actually a huge amount of cooperation in the animal kingdom. He had to flee from the Russian Secret Service, because they understood that really believing in human decency and that we can work together and we don't need them, it's a really dangerous and subversive idea.
Are anarchists good at building the kinds of institutions, though, that I would argue that modern life does need?
That's a good question. So if I would sum up the philosophy of anarchism, it would be something like, one, most people are pretty decent. Two, power corrupts. And I think that's just an excellent summary of, you know, the latest states of the psychological and sociological sciences. You know, that's pretty much what we've got, mountains of evidence for both of those statements. But the problem with anarchists is that they're not really good at building institutions. And that's particularly problematic because institutions produce people. You know, we are in so many ways shaped by the schools that we go to and the workplaces where we work and, you know, how our democracies are organized and our prisons. So I guess what I'm trying to do in the second half of my book is to take this anarchist worldview or view of human nature and then to try and implement it institutionally. What would our schools look like if we think that kids have evolved, you know, to play and to work together and to, you know, let's just unleash their creativity. And how would we organize our prisons? What would our whole criminal justice system look like? And the workplace, do we still need managers, or can we just rely on self-directed teams and employees who have their own intrinsic motivation? I guess that's what I'm trying to do in the book.
So tell me more about that then, because this is where I think we do need to press a little bit, because we didn't even get into all the science that shows that indeed there has been this growing body of evidence that shows that the human brain is wired for more goodness than we might have previously thought. But specifically with that knowledge, say what would you suggest to Jack's earlier point? Here in the United States right now, it is completely understandable if people look across their nation and feel heartbreak. They see division. They see political strife. They see social strife. They see massive inequality. How would you take this notion of recalibrating our presumption about human nature and actually apply it into policy, you know, for this country?
Well, I think we got to look simply to case studies of how things can be done differently. So maybe the best thing to start with is to think about how the whole criminal justice system, how you could totally revolutionize it. Actually, in the 1960s, the US was pioneering new ways of organizing a prison. And it was Norway who's really taken that and gone much further with it. So in the book, I talk about how they've organized prisons in Norway. And it looks pretty crazy, to be honest. So here you have these places that look like holiday resorts where the prisoners get the freedom to socialize with the guards. They can go to the cinema. They can make their own music. They've got their own music label, which is called Criminal Records. It's a very strange place. And you think, well, don't you want revenge or something like that? But then you look at the data behind it and the statistics, and you discover that actually these are the most effective prisons in the whole world. They've got the lowest recidivism rate, the lowest chance that someone will commit another crime once he or she gets out of prison. And that actually saves money in the long run as well, because you take criminals and you turn them into law-abiding, tax-paying citizens. In the US, you pretty much have the opposite. So you have a system where people go in a prison for relatively small drug offenses, for example, and they come out as hardened criminals. Very expensive, taxpayer-funded institutions that are basically like universities for more crime. Can you turn this around? Yes, I think Norway shows how to do that. And it actually, I would argue, built on a deeper American tradition as well, because as I mentioned, it was actually in the 1960s, the US, that pioneered these approaches. So there's a tradition to reconnect here with as well.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking more about Thomas Hobbes. So the Leviathan is not, it's not just governance, it's power, right? And so it is part of the problem, the challenge that the United States is facing right now, is that power has actually been so consolidated, overlaying with wealth, that it's hard, it would be hard to say the least, to get those people who make up the Leviathan in the Hobbesian sense to relinquish even a little bit of that power.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. You know, in 2019, I had the opportunity to go to Davos, you know, the place where the rich of the world come together. And I was invited out to talk about my book. And a lot of people think that when you go to a place like that, where all the billionaires are and the super powerful politicians, that you'll find these people who are very nasty and selfish and only think of themselves and, you know, who are scheming to take over the world or keep things the way they are already. But to your shock, you arrive there and you find people who are pretty nice, actually, and pretty friendly. They've just bought into a world view that is so far removed from reality, or at least the reality that most people live in, that they started to believe that their philanthropy is doing great things, while at the same time they're avoiding their taxes and they have these completely corrupt business models. So that's actually, you know, one of the shocking things and worrying things. You know, as I mentioned, it's the paradox at the heart of my book, is that people can be friendly and still be complicit in a pretty terrible system. So how do you turn that around? Well, maybe in the first place, by recognizing that power corrupts. Power is an incredibly dangerous drug. And, you know, that's true for everyone. Doesn't matter if you're on the left or the right. And nomadic hunter-gatherers already understood this. So they knew that a egalitarian society requires maintenance. Right? You should always try and keep those in power in check. Shame is an incredibly important tool here for human beings. So we are one of the only species in the whole animal kingdom who have the ability to blush. I thought that was one of the most fascinating things to discover, is that actually, you know, we blush. Why do we do that? Why has that been an evolutionary advantage to us? Well, because by blushing, we involuntarily give away our feelings. And so we establish trust between each other. But do those in power still blush? I mean, have we ever seen Donald Trump blushing, or Bolsonaro in Brazil, or Boris Johnson? I think that's the problem with those at the top. They don't blush anymore, right? They've lost this fundamental human capacity that's so important to establish trust. This is what we got to think about. How can we design institutions and mechanisms to tame those in power? Because it's pretty clear that, I mean, especially if you look at the US, that this thing that we call democracy is not very democratic anymore. Or you can ask the question if it's ever been. And it's not very good at taming those in power either.
Jack, your thoughts?
No argument from me on that. I mean, the paradox of who can govern the governors is bedeviling us. And of course, one theory is the separation of powers. We've seen that collapse under Trump, where a Senate made up of members of his own party green lights almost every depredation, almost every assault on the norms of government and democracy and his office that Trump commits. So Yeah, we're failing the test of that Madison thought his machinery would make possible. Mm.
You know what's interesting about Madison is that Madison said that ambition must be made to counteract ambition. So this was the view of the Enlightenment philosophers, that if people are selfish anyway, and especially those at the top, then you just need to create some kind of balance in the system, you know, let the selfish people control each other. But I think that's a little bit like elites looking in the mirror and thinking that the rest of humanity is just like themselves. But that's not the case. Most people are pretty decent and power corrupts, but not everyone is corrupt. So one exciting alternative that I talk about in my book when it comes to the future of democracy is what we call deliberative democracy or participatory democracy, which goes back to the original idea that the Greeks already had 2,000 years ago, that a real democracy is a place where you actually randomly select people from the population to be a politician every now and then. So then you would live in a society where, I don't know, like 20 or 30% of the population would become a politician, just like you already have in the judicial system, right? The jury system. I think you can expand that. And this is actually a really exciting thing that has been growing around the globe. There are now 1,500 cities experimenting with a form of participatory democracy. And the exciting thing is that if you assume that people can be, engaged, creative citizens who can carefully think about really difficult, controversial subjects, then they behave in that way as well. I mean, if you assume that they're just lazy and only want to watch the telly all day, then that's how they're going to behave. It's right. All about what you assume in other people is what you get out of them.
Well, I have to say, Rutger, I mean, I'm speaking to you, and actually so is Jack, from here in New England, a corner of the United States that still loves its town meeting with lots of local members of the community coming together to make decisions. But at least in the community that I live, we're running into the problem that, in fact, governance has become so complex and complicated and requires so much expertise that it outstrips the ability of normal citizens to make informed decisions in. But that we'll have a conversation about that on another day. We have barely under 2 minutes to go, and I wanted to ask you one last thing. The examples of these sort of more emergent, natural, decent, cooperative societies that we've touched on so far in this hour are smaller scale. Now, what about the fact that modern life is actually lived so on a much larger, vaster scale? And I'm thinking specifically in the realm of information and media, a lot of what you say requires the decency emerges because we know each other. We physically might know each other, or we're living in the same neighborhoods. But so much of modern life is lived virtually through corrupted information. I mean, we've just got a minute to go. How can the principles that you're talking about, 60 seconds, Rutger, be applied in a world where mob mentality is so easy on, say, social media?
Yeah. Well, delete your social media account. That's a great first step. And the second thing is that, I mean, there are lots of examples, actually, of organizations that maybe do not get that much attention in the press, but actually do manage to cooperate on a much bigger scale. I've got one example from my own country, the Netherlands, where you have this hugely successful healthcare organization called Neighborhood Care, with 15,000 employees and no management at all. And the central philosophy of that company is just most people are decent. And it turns out that they managed to deliver healthcare at a cheaper cost and of higher quality than all the competitors. So I think you can actually scale this up. And I'm very excited by sort of the movement of people who are already trying to do this, but who do not really know they're part of a movement yet. In the book, I'm trying to connect the dots and trying to show that something bigger is going on.
Well, Rutger Bregman's new book is Humankind, A Hopeful History. We've got an excerpt at onpointradio.org. Rutger, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, thank you as always, Jack.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.